you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, this isn't a good object lesson. Sometimes stuff really does happen despite one's best efforts. Yesterday, I reconfirmed my guest for today, who I'm excited to talk about, because the guy is a four times he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, in addition to having won twice. And he said he was excited to be on the show, and everything was great. And I call, and now, you know, I call like 2 minutes ago to get him ready on the show and answering machine. So hopefully maybe he just stepped out to the bathroom and we'll get back on in a moment. But in any case, while we're, hopefully he will join us. But what I'll do in the meantime, of course, is I have other stuff to share with you. We'll try to, as they say, turn lemons into lemonade. And so I'm just going to offer some tips and career-related tips, and hopefully he will join us. For those of you who are job seekers, I should tell you who this guy was. This guy has written a book called Billion Dollar Ball. We're going to take a really look into the world of the careers in college athletics, both the athletic director and the athletes, whom he argues is very exploited. We will look at both of those quasi-careers, hopefully when he joins us. But in the meantime, kind of the bread and butter of the show is many people are job seekers. And even in this era of ostensible low unemployment, there are many people who are unemployed or underemployed or unhappily employed and looking for a new job. And I like to talk about what is unconventional wisdom, not the same old usual truths. The standard interview advises, convey passion. I have found that actually, in many cases, it is better, as well as more honest, better that is more expedient, to say that you are past the passion phase in your career. That is, you know, everybody in the new part of their career are ecstatic or ready to go, they're really enthusiastic. But if you say, you know, I'd be lying to you to say that I am passionate about this work, but I'm a professional. And when after you've been doing it a while, the blush is off the rose in the same way as in a new relationship. The passion is greater than ongoing, but there may be a greater depth to the relationship long term. Same is true in jobs. Saying, I'm a pro, and yes, it's a job. It's one I like. But if you're looking at me to jump up and down, you've got the wrong person. Now, of course, some employers are going to buy the you got to be passionate thing, and maybe that's the way the employer justifies you working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and hopes to get that, grind that out of you. But many employers will appreciate that you would rather have a professional who does the job professionally and is honest enough to say the truth about that they like the job but are not passionate than somebody who's going to do the typical, play the typical job seeker role of being Mr. or Ms. Passion. So, just a thought. Another bit of unconventional wisdom. We normally think of the perfectionist as somebody who is doing everything to the nth degree. If he or she is a carpenter, they're going to make sure that that door, that there is an equal 1/16th of an inch all the way across the door, and there will not be any deviation from that. But the true perfectionist, the wiser perfectionist, is someone who makes perfect use not of his or her work, in other words, not make doing everything to the 1/16th of an inch necessarily, but perfect use of his or her time. That person notes when their efforts are passing the point of diminishing returns. Time is what's worth being a perfectionist about, not necessarily doing everything to absolute perfection. Even a surgeon could obviously take things to the ultimate level, but then the surgery takes too long, puts the patient at greater risk too much anesthesia. The true perfectionist surgeon is saying, how much stitching is exactly right? How careful does one actually have to be? How slow does one have to be? And that is, I invite you, as you, whatever your work, whether you're a clerk or you're a CEO, to ask yourself, are you misdirecting your perfectionism to something that ultimately doesn't matter that much? It appears that we have not gotten our guest, the author of Billion Dollar Ball, which would take us into the world of college sports and the careers and jobs therein and the ethical issues that are embedded. We will keep trying him, but for those of you who are joining to listen to that, it's not happening right now, but hopefully what will happen right now is helping you. If you or someone you care about has got any kind of a work-related problem, either unemployed, underemployed, well-employed, and yet still unhappy, existential questions, or, you know, I pride myself on focusing on reality. Too often, self-help shows are all about, you know, unfettered optimism. You can do it, just work hard enough. In balance, and I welcome, you know, I offer positivity where I can, but if you are one of those many people who, despite significant effort, have not landed a good job, and want to talk about what your experience has been like in trying to land a job, I welcome your calling as well. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemko, 415-841-4134. That's for either what I call a workover. You want some career help for you or someone you love. Or if you want to just simply tell your story, success story, failure story, and in a variation on that theme, I'm interested, you know, I've watched the Shark Tank a few times, and I'm interested in the notion of how carefully they vet prospective people who are small business owners who want an investment. So if you would like my version of the Shark Tank on you, if you have a small business idea and you would like to call me to run the business idea and I would tell you if and whether I would invest, you can call us for that as well. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemko and KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And to the phones, welcome to the show. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind? Hello.
Hi, Marty. Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I hear you beautifully.
All right. So I'll give you a little bit of background. My name's Manny, and I graduated with a biotechnology degree back in 07. I've been working as a lab technician since, and I've had the pleasure of working for a couple of major biotech companies here in the Bay Area. So it hasn't been a problem finding employment. It's just I haven't quite made it past that entry-level technician level. I've applied to numerous positions, and I've usually been told, you know, there's people either with PhDs or 10 to 15 years experience in the industry that I'm competing with. So that's really had me start thinking about doing a career transition. But having a biotechnology background, it's been a little difficult to see what other options there would be if I don't want to be in the lab anymore.
Right, and I'm assuming you have one of those bachelor's degrees in biotechnology, you know, wet work, is
yes,
that correct?
Bachelor of Science. From UC Davis, that's correct.
Right. Okay, so which of the following, these are some transitions that people have normally made from the bench, and you tell me which of these, if any, hold some appeal to you. Quality control, regulatory affairs, sales that is, for example, of consumables that are used in the biotech industry. Nobody would know better about, you know, what works, what doesn't work, and how than you. Do any of those resonate with you, or are they all off base?
The sales part, the one that I have been looking at a little bit. Then it just kind of gets into, I don't know if I want to do a sales career. I guess the other thing is I'm thinking long term. You know, I'm also thinking, I'm 30 now. I don't know if I'm going to do another career transition another 10 or 20 years down the road. So I'd like to pick something that I want to stick with. And I've been talking to a few salespeople. And the one thing they've been telling me is you really need to be in touch with your personality. Are you the type of person that will burn out doing sales? And initially when I had these conversations, I didn't know what they were referring to. But when I talked to some of these guys that have been doing it for 10 to 15 years, I've kind of seen both avenues. Some people that I literally just feel like, you know, I've got 10 to 15 years under my belt, so I can't leave sales, and this is what I do. So,
okay.
So that's kind of been the other one I've been leaning towards out of the ones you said was regulatory affairs. I mean, that's kind of, from what I've seen, a cubicle environment. You're in front of a computer. It's
yes.
A lot of documents.
Yes.
And, you know, so that would be a good change of environment outside of what I'm used to right now is a lot of clean spaces, clean rooms.
Right.
I mean, you can't even get a drink of water
right.
without stepping out.
Right. I'm going to make the arguments for both, and you tell me, because I can lend a different perspective. I've had many clients who have been in the biotech industry and in sales, and so I'm going to hopefully provide a little broader perspective than the few people you may have spoken to about sales. You know, first of all, the notion that sales is a dead end is absolutely ridiculous. Many people started in sales and become sales managers, quality control managers, customer service managers, business development people, directors of sales, vice presidents, and even have become CEOs. So to say that it's a dead end implies to me that the particular salespeople you spoke to either had a very narrow focus or weren't that good, and so they were not likely to rise. Number two, a key to a good sales career, by the way, you can't look at a 40-year time horizon. Too much will change in your world and in the world to plan for more than a 5 to 10-year horizon at most. There always are pivot points and ways to pivot from there. So I'm more interested in what might be the wisest use of your next 5 to 10 years. And with regard to a sales career being meaningful, it really ends up coming down to what I call vetting. Vetting their employer. There are disgusting employers who have products that are inferior and only make it in the market because of heavy marketing and high-pressure closing and sales. There are those that are overpriced, and then there are those that are truly worthy, either because they are less expensive equivalents or they are demonstrably better. And if you are selling a line of products from, let's say, a Becton Dickinson, which sells a lot of stuff into the biotech industry, and you really are, instead of trying to slam them because you want to maximize your quota and maximize the sales rate and get your stupid trip to Hawaii, if instead you go and you try to be a true problem solver and truly ask the potential customer, where are your pain points? What's the problem with your current supplier? And be a real problem solver, you can ultimately you may not break all sales records because your ethics is taking precedence over getting that short-term sale, but ultimately you will feel more rewarded and less likely to burn out, as well as likely be the kind of person who can later get promoted. When I say that to you, first of all, and I'll get to the regulatory affairs in a minute, but when I describe that to you, in your heart of hearts, Manny, does that feel like you or does that not feel like you?
No, definitely. That definitely feels like me. I think, as with any transition, I think that the biggest hesitation is it's always moving from something familiar to uncharted territory.
And one of the ways you can put your toe into the waters of that uncharted territory is start by simply Googling the term sales. And you will no doubt get articles on the art of selling, spin selling, Little Red Book of Selling, all these different sales things. And it'll either make you puke or it'll make you feel like, okay, I could see this being me. And then the next little baby step would be to find an online forum. You can be sure that there are online forums, not just generically for salespeople, but in biotech sales. See what kind of questions the participants on the forum are raising. What kind of comments are making? Are you saying to yourself, is this a profession I'd be proud to join, or is this making me feel oily? That would be, and then what you do is a ride along. The next stage would be to, if there are for this, for example, baybio.org is a website that has lots and lots of seminars and events for people in all aspects of biotech. Go to one of those meetings. Talk to those men and women. Ask if you find one that you like. Ask if you can do a ride-along, going with them to an outside sales call, asking yourself if this is who you are or this is not who you are. That's how you can put the toe in the water without making the big transition and pushing for the job. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, let's talk regulatory affairs. Regulatory affairs, for better or worse, there is job security in that galore. It takes, and I heard this from somebody who's in regulatory affairs at, I'll just say, one of the leading biotech companies in the world, and he says for a new drug, it takes 3 truckloads, literally, either if they were printed out, of course it's all done online now, but it would take 3 truckloads of paper printed out to meet all of the FDA and related requirements. So there is no question that there is going to be a need. Now, some would say, I'm not making a political judgment here, some would say it's absolutely excellent protection of patient safety, etc. Others would say it's bureaucracy gone amok. But there's no question that if you are attracted, as you said you were, to the idea of an office job, not wet work in the lab, that is certainly what it is, and that will stay viable for a long time. And Yes, of course, more higher degrees in general. We live in a brand name degree-driven society. And so, of course, getting a master's and a PhD may help. But before I did that, if you weren't particularly thrilled about going back to school, which you implied, I would try to work my way up from the bottom as a regulatory affairs assistant, see how you liked it. And very often there are people who, by dint of their experience and the networking they do, can move up the ladder to an acceptable level. Having listened to both sides of the story, the regulatory affairs story and the sales story, what does Manny feel if there was, he trusted the God within himself, the wise man, what would bring out the best in him and what he would enjoy, what would Manny pick?
I would think I'd be leaning towards the regulatory affairs just because of the reasons you mentioned, the possibility of doing it without going back to school through networking, as well as the job security. Before getting my degree, I had a stint in sales. It was completely unrelated. It was real estate sales, of all places, with the bubble was going on.
Yep.
And I'm not saying bio would be different or not, but I did get the website. You gave me paybio.org.
Right.
So I will be reaching out to a few folks on there and definitely trying the ride-alongs and seeing, at this stage, if I'm going to make a transition with the 5 to 10 years you mentioned, I think it's worth to take a good, long, hard look at both of those sides of the business.
There's one other angle which is a little less different. The other field that is likely to continue to burgeon that is a logical pivot point from biotech wet work would be doing medical wet work, working, being a lab technologist for one of those, for example, for Quest Diagnostics, those big companies, because it is cheaper to do tests, blood tests and urine tests, than it is to do procedures. And so because there's going to be ever greater cost control concerns, as we no doubt will start to ensure ever more people who are low pay into the Affordable Care Act, including the illegal immigrants, once comprehensive immigration reform occurs, there will be endless need for great lab technologists. And, of course, the scientists are doing an ever better job of coming up with tests that are more accurate. So if you wanted to not make such a big pivot into sales or regulatory affairs, instead of biotech, which is more research-centric in general, biotech wet work, you might want to consider working for one of those labs that does medical testing for patients. Does that have more or less appeal?
That definitely does. It's something that I think that's the one side that I think has been discussed most with me from career fairs and kind of career counselors.
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Marty, but would that require the CLS, the Clinical Lab Scientist certification?
It could well be, and I don't. Now you've reached the end of the limits of my knowledge.
Yeah.
So, sometimes there's an equivalency that doesn't require the official certification. Sometimes it does. I don't know, but that's something you could Google and get. That's a factual piece of detail information you can get immediately from Googling.
Got it. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for calling Work with Marty Namco. Okay, if you or someone you love has got a work-related problem, whether it's science or not science, whether it's entry-level or C-level, CEO-level, I usually can help. The phone number here at Work with Marty Namco, for what I call a workover, or if you want to tell your story, either your success story in trying to land a job or your failure story, or you have a business idea you want to run by me, I'll be like the Shark Tank without quite so many teeth. The phone number here at Work with Marty Namco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. I had every intention of speaking with a guest I was very much looking forward to. For those of you who are just joining us and expecting that, Gilbert Gall, who is the author of Billion Dollar Ball, was going to be quite revelatory about what careers are really like in the world of big-time college sports, from athletic director to college athletes, who, in fact, it is a profession. And perhaps an often exploited one, but all kinds of interesting ethical and practical issues. Alas, despite having conferred with him yesterday, when I called this morning to get him on the line, all I got was an answering machine. So he's a good enough guest. The pre-interview went really very well. I think he's terrific, that I will try to reschedule him unless he doesn't show. We've left a voicemail for him, and hopefully he will call in. But in the meantime, I think what I'll do is I'll give one more tip here, a career tip, and then we're going to go back to the phones. This I have long said, we all like to be proven that we're right, and I have been long talking about how potent the world of government employment is relative to non-government. A larger percentage of GDP is government employment, and certainly we've all known that manufacturing has been offshored. But I just read a statistic that came out this month from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The ratio of government employees to manufacturing employees in the United States is now 1.8 to 1. There are 1.8 government workers for every one manufacturing worker. The number precisely is there are 22 million people who work for government in the United States, only 12 million who work for manufacturing. So, you know, unless, you know, if you, and I've said this many times, the unvarnished truth is that if you are a star, you are brilliant, you are hardworking, you have great technical skills as well as people skills and leadership skills, yes, corporate America is going to hire you, treasure you, give you a good salary, you'll have job stability and all that. But if you are a mere mortal, especially given that an ever larger number of jobs in this country are in government, you'd be wise to go that route because that is the last bastion of stability and benefits and vacation and holidays and for non-stars. So anyway, back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help, or what's on your mind?
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi. Okay, so my scenario is this. I'm 53. I was a commodity broker. Mm-hmm. And I just recently got my law degree because I was thinking about going into law. And my main background is in sales. And I don't have a lot of great computer skills. I sort of missed that part. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I'm computer friendly, but I can't, yeah, you know, be Excel, XML, whatever.
Right.
And so I have been trying to find a career that would be suitable for me at my time with upside potential, which obviously would include sales. But my recent sales experiences have been disastrous. And so I was curious. If you had any suggestions or counsel for a guy in my situation.
Sure. I want to hear what was disastrous about your sales experiences recently.
Well, my last recent sales experience, I was selling for credit card processing. I was a loan officer for a little bit, and I just, that personality-wise just didn't work out for me. I just didn't like the business.
Okay, great. Well, my no-brainer reaction always is to try to combine the different elements of a person into one because that makes them uniquely qualified. So you're in sales. You have a law degree. You're a commodities broker. Well, there is commodities law. You can be sure there's all kinds of lawsuits and transactional law related to commodities. And you can be sure there is software that's available, whether it be discovery software that would be, you know, they have automated discovery or law office management software. What I would do if I were you is I would find some products, some legal products that get sold, and I would make my target market, who I would market them to, law firms that had at least one specialty practice in commodities law. Does that make sense?
Yeah. This is a little simple.
Sometimes it's simple. All right. When I have a client laughing, I mean, or a caller laughing, I mean, I don't get better than that. So I'll get you off the phone. That's your job, dude. Make a list of... List number one is excellent, high-quality software, or you're not a computer guy, so any products or services, you know, the services that provide giving notice to subpoenaed people. It could be office management consulting services. But find maybe the best non-software products that could sold to law firms. Make a list of those. The premier companies, then make a list of local law firms that maybe 10 or so that have a specialty practice in commodities brokers. Write letters to the director of sales at those companies that sell the software sell the other products and services to law firms and say, here are some of the, I have been a commodities broker, I'm a lawyer. Here are a few of the leads that I would follow up with if you hired me for sales, and hire me and I'll show you 20 more. Does that make sense?
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. So in other words, create a list of companies that sell software. Create a list of...
Not software because you're not a computer guy. A list of companies that sell great products for law firms.
Gotcha. And then create a local list and then write to the director of sales and point out a few that I would sell with my...
Nope. A local list of law firms that have a commodities practice.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
Right? Because that's going to be more compelling. Anybody can create a list of law firms. But if you say, hey... You know, you've got this great product. I like it. Here, I have a lot of experience in the commodities world. Here is a partial list of the law firms in the Bay Area that specialize in commodities. These are a few of the leads I would call. I have a longer list than that. Hire me, and I'll show them to you. That's what I'm talking about.
I see. Okay, well, hey, thank you very much for that insight. It's very much appreciated, I can tell.
My pleasure.
That's a good outline. Thank you very much.
There you go. The price is certainly right. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco. Before I go back to the phones, I'll give out the phone number. If you or someone you care about has got a work-related problem, I can usually help. Or you want to tell your story. Love to hear stories. We all love stories. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for a workover or for your story. Or you want to play Shark Tank with me, where you can propose your business idea and I will ask you some questions and let you know if I would invest or not. Phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco for all those reasons here at KALW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Before I go back to the phones, I'd like to intersperse with tips. Have you ever experienced this? You read, let's say you're a manager or your employer or whatever, and you read somebody's awesome resume or bio on LinkedIn, and then you end up working with them and they're meh, right? So, you know, unfortunately, we do live in a world of hype, and that is part of the reason I do love public radio. It is less hypey than so much of the world in which we live in. It feels like it's longer on the substance than on the sizzle. So, really, whether you are somebody yourself and you have bought the conventional wisdom that you need to puff your resume or puff your bio and puff your LinkedIn profile, in the end, what ends up happening is you create heightened, unrealistic expectations, which end up often disappointing, and then you get fired or laid off, or simply, and forgive me for invoking the cosmic scheme of things, but that is where I really try to think with my aspirational thinking. In a cosmic sense of things, when you're overhyping yourself, it really is unfair to you, to the potential employers, to the coworkers, and ultimately to society. Stop with the hype, all right? All right, we got lots of callers on the line, so let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Okay, am I on the air?
You are.
Okay, thanks, Marty.
Sure.
Yes, I wanted to propose and discuss a business idea.
Yep.
I've been, for the last 30 years, I've been working with for-profits and also high-tech companies in the area of managing the multicultural workforce.
Right.
And for the last 5 years, I've been teaching a class at a local university in the graduate engineering program on strategies for success for foreign-born
yep.
professionals.
Yep.
And I was involved and started the first... project in Silicon Valley that looked at the career development for foreign-born professionals back in 30 years ago.
Sounds good.
So now I'm interested in, I've set up a website, I'm interested in focus and taking that beyond the classroom
mm-hmm.
and maybe approaching some career centers at the big universities or international houses, international, you know, centers
mm-hmm.
at the universities and career centers to put on workshops for foreign-born high-tech professionals and foreign-born professionals in general who want to be more effective. We're going into the American workplace and want to be more effective and want to advance their career. Most of the foreign-born in Silicon Valley, who are, you know, most Asians, Indians, and Chinese, are
right.
kind of stuck at kind of a mid-professional
Correct.
Level, having a hard time moving into the managerial and executive level.
Correct. You say you were speaking of it as a business. You know, to universities generally hire outsiders normally for, you know, at very little money. If they, for example, will hire you to teach a course, you know, they'll pay you $5,000 or $8,000 for the course, and it takes you so much work to develop the course or whatever. That's not really a business. It's survival. Is money an issue for you? You imply it's a business, or is this more about you looking for greater outlets for what you're doing?
Well, money is one issue. What I had in mind was kind of more workshops.
Right, I know.
Just a regular class.
It's hard for me to picture universities that offer so many zillions of courses hiring an outsider to do workshops. I think your best shot really is with the with companies that have large numbers of these people and putting on these workshops for corporations. Frankly, I just got hired, or at least I've been solicited to do a two-day $15,000 workshop for executives in Mexico. I mean, that is a lot of money. And for whatever reason, corporations are the ones willing to pay serious dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would, if it were me, and I wanted to build that part of my business, I would focus on that, and I would, in one of whatever, if I don't have great video already, I would, video is critical, because show, don't tell is much more compelling, showing is much more compelling than telling. I would have a two things. I would have a great outline of what I do in my workshop, and I would have a video heavily edited where the next workshop you do, you get somebody to video it, and there's a videographer under every rock here in the Bay Area, and they all edit with the software, and get it edited to 2 minutes of your best stuff. And so I would encourage you to do that, to have that, and then send it to any, you know, for starters, if you haven't recently had experience with the very big companies, I would probably start smaller and go to, you know, the companies that are have 50, you know, 20 to 100 employees, many of whom are, as you say, you know, high-tech companies and therefore more likely to have Asian immigrant workers who they want to move from entry-level or mid-level to leadership. Somebody that might have 3 or 5 people, they may hire you either to do one-on-one coaching with them or a workshop for 5 or for the 3 or 5 or 10 people who they would like to at least raise the possibility that of moving into a higher level. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, Marty. I was thinking of maybe doing that with my class, which is ongoing, kind of making a video out of the exercises that I do in my class and having that edited.
I think that's fine. It's. I'm guessing that your students, those are going to be kids, and it's going to be, people are just so literal that if you're sending a video of just you teaching a bunch of young adults, they're going to be nervous about your ability to generalize from that to dealing with mid-level employees who you're trying to groom for senior management. So if by any chance, even if you need to do it for free, if you could do a workshop for people who are older than 22. You know, who are maybe, you know, 28, 30, 35, 40.
Yeah, well, those my students are in that age range. This
great.
Is a graduate engineering program.
Love it. Okay.
Designed for working professionals.
That sounds great to me. Okay, I will let you go because I am delighted to say that finally my guest is on the line. So I hope that helps somewhat. Okay, so for those of you who are just joining us, the original plan was at the top of the show to talk to a guy I was very excited to talk with because he is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize in addition to 4 times being nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and he's the author of a book called Billion Dollar Ball. And it gets us into the world of the professions of in college sports, which has gone from a kind of a nice little avocation for college students to a big-time business. So we learn a lot about what it's like to be a college athletic director and, indeed, what it's like to be a big-time college athlete, which is a profession in itself. So now it is my pleasure, better late than never, to introduce the author of Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football, Gil Gall. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hey, Marty. I apologize for that. My landline was dead when I came in here, and it took a while to figure out, and I had to reset a modem.
Well, I'm
sorry
glad.
About that.
Well, you know, you have worked so hard and so long over your life and with such excellence that you have a dispensation certainly from me, and it's a pleasure to have you on
that,
the show.
I'm happy to be on the show. Thank you.
Outstanding. Well, how have athletic directors, those are the big cheeses in the athletic programs at colleges, yeah. how have athletic directors gone from people who just mainly hired coaches and managed
yeah.
small budgets to CEOs of large, lucrative, standalone businesses called college football and basketball programs, including right here in the Bay Area at Stanford and Berkeley, whose football team, as we speak, I might mention, is ranked 22 in the nation. So they're clearly in this game.
That's right. And they lost a tough game last night.
Oh, did they lose? Forgive me. I'm not much of a sports fan.
They did. Apparently, I checked this morning. I did not stay up because I just can't stay up that late. Anyway, so that's a good question. The answer is, involves a little bit of history. And what I'd say to you is what has changed in all of this is the scale of the money. And largely what we're talking about is football. Football has become the economic engine of these elite athletic departments.
Not basketball?
Stanford, USC, UCLA, Cal Berkeley.
Not basketball, too?
Everything.
Isn't basketball the same? Isn't that in the same category?
Basketball?
Yeah. March Madness?
I would say it's in the same neighborhood, but it's, you know, it's not nearly as lucrative as college football. College football dwarfs everything. It accounts at the elite football schools, and we're talking about these 65 schools that belong to the so-called 5 power conferences,
mm-hmm.
And that includes a couple of the ones you mentioned and I mentioned. Football will account for roughly about 70% of all the revenue that they take in the athletic department
mm-hmm.
budgets,
mm-hmm.
and these budgets are now not uncommonly $100 million, sometimes considerably more. So what happened was this didn't happen overnight. Schools have always stressed football, but not really like they are today. And then a series, in the 1980s, a series of events, and I'm not going to go into them now unless you want me to, a series of events occurred that enabled the schools to monetize their football programs, to generate these huge sums of money from television fees, seat donations, tickets.
Right. But what's wrong with that? What's wrong with all that money going into college football and basketball?
Let me answer your question first, and then I'll get to the question of, is there anything wrong with it? And that's not a word I use, by the way. Anyway, so as football evolves into an economic model, the old role model of the athletic director, which basically was you took your football coach when you retired him and you stuck him in the athletic chair. And so that no longer works. I mean, you're talking about gigantic businesses, huge businesses. They're complicated. They're incredibly sophisticated. And there's all this money running through, and there's the pressure to keep the money running through. And so you need people who actually understand business and finance. Mm-hmm. And if you looked at an athletic department at a place like Stanford or a place like USC, you'd be stunned by how many people are working in there, 200, 400 employees, and all the things that they're doing. So now, if you want me to talk about, you know, this question of what's wrong with it, it's, I don't use the word wrong. What I do is I try to point out the effects that turning your football program into basically a standalone entertainment division of the university has on the university. And that ranges from everything from admitting athletes who otherwise wouldn't have a chance to be admitted academically, and may not have any interest in learning while they're there, to the millions of dollars you have to spend to keep them eligible and on the playing, maintain their eligibility to keep playing, let alone to get a degree. To paying a football coach $5 to $7 million, which is probably 10 times what you're paying the president, let alone what you're paying a poor tenured professor, to using football as your primary brand instead of education, to the tax issues. All of this is tax-free to schools because it's covered by this umbrella of education, and Congress has lumped college football into that, even with all of the commercial changes that have occurred to college football.
So, in some sense, yes, it is like so much in society, it is redistributive. It is redistributing money away from the academically superior students to students and to programs that would help millions of large numbers of inner city kids to get a free ride scholarship and have a shot at education with a lot of tutoring. And those monies, all that big money, the money that comes in from the, you know, the TV revenues and the advertising, all the rest of it, not only supports the football teams and such, but it supports the women's sports, which are not self-supporting, and the government requires there be a nearly equal number of participants. So in the end, is it really that big a deal?
Well, again, I don't look at it that way, whether it's good or bad or a big deal or a small deal. I mean, I think it's a big enough deal that it's worth thinking about. So let's say that and get that out of the way.
Sure.
I mean, I think you're raising a number of issues. One would be, were it that it worked the way you're describing, where these inner city kids come in and are all real student athletes and able to devote as much time to their academics, to getting a degree, as they do to playing football and training for football. Were that truly the case, then essentially you would be describing the Division III model of amateur athletics, the smaller schools that don't give out scholarships, where the athletes, for the most part, are real students. At a lot of the large football schools, you always have a few kids, or maybe even more than a few kids. And let's throw Stanford, I'll put them aside for a moment because they're a special case. Cal Berkeley, to a certain extent. But you're always going to have some kids who go in there and they're real students and they're able to balance it and juggle it. But you know what? If you go and look at these large programs like that I did, what you discover is that it takes an enormous amount of money and hand-holding. In some cases, even knocking on their doors to make sure they get up in the morning and go to class, and then following them across campus to have them sign in to show the coach that they showed up for class.
Right.
I mean, it's extraordinary. The amount of money spent on tutoring, on learning specialists, on psychologists, on life skills coaches, it's enormous. And so when you step back and think about this, and you say, okay, what's wrong with that? Really, the way I look at it is, you know, there's two ways to think about it. One is, okay, the school's being morally responsible to these athletes they recruit, and they're trying to help them on the academic side. Fine. You want to think that way? Okay. On the other way to think about it is, it's one more example of the lengths that these schools are forced to go to in order to keep these players on the field generating all of the enormous sums of money. Now, for the cross subsidies, it's absolutely true. Football pays for the poor sports, largely, although not exclusively. You still see a fair amount of money coming from the schools in the form of student activities fees that get passed along to athletic departments. Even at some of the really rich schools, like Alabama, there's still some of that money. Mm. But it does do that. So the question I have is, okay, that's all well and good, but if you truly believe that participating in a sport, whether it's football or volleyball or field hockey, is educational, which is what the presidents will claim. If you truly believe that, then pull it all back inside the university. Run it the way you would run any other department in the university. Don't run it as a profit-making entertainment business, which is what basically these schools are doing.
So it seems to me, and I'm curious really as to your reaction, that the problem with it being a profit-making institution is the actual dollars itself. There's something that being so pecuniary is somehow tainting its the ideological purism that is higher ed.
No, I'm not a purist. I mean, for example, I don't have a problem with paying the players, say, $5,000 in this so-called full cost of attendance, which the Power Five conferences are going to do. That's not really the issue. The issue is that it taints things in the sense that it changes everything. It's not just that the numbers are large. It's where the money goes and what it does and the impact that it has on the academics and on the university. So I'll give you a great example. I went around to a number of schools, and one of the things I was interested in was, okay, how much do you pay for a football player? And you can slice and dice that in any number of other ways. You can just look at the scholarship. You can look at the cost per player. You can look at it in a number of ways. But in any case, it's always a really large number, you know, $40,000, $50,000, and if you just do per player, it can be $200,000 or more. And then I looked at, okay, well, does the school, if it's a public university, does the school have an honors college, which many large public universities mm-hmm. do these days? Mm-hmm. That's where the best and the brightest, the most ambitious kids go. And, you know, in theory, they get a better education, right? They have more access to classes, to getting closer to professors, doing research, and so on
right.
and so forth.
Right.
And so I compared what the schools gave those kids in terms of scholarship money with what they were spending on their football players. And you know what? They were spending like 10 times more on mm-hmm. football players than they were on their smartest and brightest students. Now, that turns our notion, our priorities, and our values of education upside down, in my opinion.
That, to me, is the, to use the legal term, dispositive argument. That is a killer argument. It's the opportunity cost argument. So
it is an opportunity cost.
Right.
And when
so,
you ask presidents about that, I mean, they get tongue-tied. They
right.
don't know how to answer that one.
That's the right one. So, in other words, imagine they, dear listeners, and Gil, imagine that you are the president of a college, and by fiat, the government said, no more of this crap. All football is going to be Division III, and now you have all these tens of millions of dollars in your coffers to allocate to the students who can make the most of it, whether it be honors programs, depending on your politics. It could be honors programs. It could be, you know, marginally qualified academically students. We'll leave that to another day, where to reallocate. But imagine
right.
you had $10 million
yep.
to be able to devote to the not only academic but the extracurricular, co-curricular,
yep.
Substance abuse, gender abuse, microaggressions, all of the million academic and co-curricular issues. Think of what would do greater good for society, funding the damn football team or using it as we outlined. Is that a fair way to, in a more radio talk show host-like way to argue it?
I don't think they're necessarily mutually exclusive. I don't think it's a linear argument. I think that you can play football and play it well and competitively and in an within this umbrella of education. I mean, the D3 schools do it all
mm-hmm.
the time. It's just that it's a different philosophy.
Right.
It's about participation. It's not about money, and it's not about using football to brand your university. That's the difference.
Absolutely. I played Division III baseball for 4 years. I loved it, and it was a true enhancement of my experience. But yes, pleasure without question. I derived great pleasure just simply putting the uniform on and being part of the team. But it really was, it felt like high-stakes discipline. It was an integration of my brain and my body. And you know, I learned a lot of leadership from my good coach. And learning, winning, and losing. I mean, these are cliches, but they were truly educational to me. And right, scholarships were irrelevant, and it was wonderful that we were treating it as that and not as a business. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. We're talking about careers in the crazy big world of big-time college athletics, and from athletic directors to people who we don't think of as having a profession, but truly, as this book Billion Dollar Ball outlines, college athletes in those 65 big-time football schools are really professionals working full-time as at their craft. By the way, how full-time really is the work of a college athlete, football player, today? Is it 12 months a year? Is it 3 months a year? How many hours a day?
Oh, it's 12 months a year. I mean, from the moment you're recruited in high school and you arrive on campus, and surprising numbers of the high school kids are now finishing high school early so they can arrive 6 months earlier to their football schools, with the idea being that they'll have an additional 6 months to get ready and they may be able to play as freshmen, despite the fact that, you know, they're probably immature, they're 18 years old, whatever. But they have great skills. You know, it starts with, you know, bringing in these football players in the summer before school starts. They have this thing called bridge program at a lot of the big schools, which is intended to, you know, do what it says, bridge between high school and college, and get the athletes somewhat used to the idea of being at a college and the demands and all of that. They use the summer to load up on easy credits so that they don't have to take so many classes during the season, and they have more time to train. They're training year-round. The facilities for training at the large football schools are absolutely extraordinary these days. Oregon just opened a year ago a $70 million football performance center, which is, it's just breathtaking to walk through this building. Phil Knight paid for it. He also paid for the $42 million academic support center for football players and other athletes.
Apart from the cost, you know what annoys me terribly, I must admit, is the bulking up. You know, they call it a performance center, but that is a nice sanitized marketing phrase for getting people bulked up to unhealthy weights, and then after they stop playing football, which I imagine large numbers of people, you know, at that point stop being quite as physical, they turn into tubs of lard and then one big cardiovascular risk.
Well, it's a huge issue. That's for sure. I mean, the weight rooms. I was at Oregon. They had a in their new center. They had a 25,000 square foot weight room.
Exactly.
With hardwood floors made of Ipe Brazilian hardwood, which apparently is the hardest wood in the world. And the tour guide told me that's important because it doesn't catch on fire. And I was sort of flummoxed by this. What do you mean these things catch on fire? And he said, yeah, they do. So Alabama opened up a 37,000 square foot weight room center in a $9 million locker room with a small waterfall in it. I mean, the facilities are just extraordinary. Lots of people have said this. There's clearly an arms race going on to get these kids.
It really speaks to, you know, America. You know, while I'm certainly no fan of Islamic extremism, but you could see how somebody from a completely different culture looks at American culture with its focus on marketing, on sports, on fashion, on the shallowest of things, you know, could be repulsed.
I'm not going to go there. I mean, I'm sure it's strange. We're really the only country in the world that does this. Canada gives up a few schools have athletic scholarships, but in the rest of the world, it's basically done through club sports.
Yeah, let's talk about, if I were, you know, we're sitting here, this is typical NPR stuff, you know, really high-minded, sanctimonious stuff. Let's look at the reality. Let's say that I'm a president of a college, and I say, I've read Gil Gall's book, Billion Dollar Ball, and you're right, I'm contributing to the obscenity of all of this, and damn it, I don't care about my damn alumni with their season tickets and big million-dollar legacy donations and all the rest of that crap. We are going to be Division III. Small-time football is a wonderful thing. as an amateur, safe, not bulked up activity, no scholarships, minimal expenditures. We're going to spend our money on all students learning and co-curriculars. And would you guess that president would likely lose his or her job immediately and be replaced by somebody who'd simply feed the college sports leviathan?
I do. I think there's probably almost 100% chance he or she would lose his or her job. I asked a number of presidents that exact question, and that's what they said to me. They said, you know, if I did that, you know, I wouldn't be here. So I read the story in the New York Times by Dan Barry about 2 weeks ago with the Notre Dame president, in which he was saying, you know, look, if we go to this model where we're going to start paying the players beyond this little few thousand dollars of extra money, you know, then Notre Dame would seriously have to look at retrenching, stepping back, and, you know, playing football, trying to find some like-minded schools to play at another level. And I thought to myself, that's not going to happen. If you announce that tomorrow, you're not going to have a job, you know, within a matter of hours probably at Notre Dame.
Yep.
I mean, could you imagine? They have their own television contract with NBC for $15 million a year just for football. And there's all this other money. You know, you have all the hoopla and the alumni and the, you know, the subway alumni in New York City and the rest of it. And, you know, for better or for worse, I mean, that's really probably the first thing you think about when you think about Notre Dame, which is, in a way, a little sad because Notre Dame is a
fine institution, right? Exactly.
You know, first rate.
What I don't understand is the stupid alumni and fans in general. I was as I said, I played ball in college, Division III, and I would watch sports a lot. And then in the year 90, shows how old I am. In 1964, there was a guy named Curt Flood. Curt Flood played for the St. Louis Cardinals. He was a star.
Yep.
And he decided that he didn't want to be chained to the St. Louis Cardinals because there was a rule back then. Once you were you signed with one major league team, that was what you were, so that the fans could develop an allegiance to you and to the team, etc. Well, he challenged that and won in the courts, and he developed what's called free agency. And now players are willing to go to the to another team for a few thousand dollars more. So if they're not loyal, how can they expect fans to be loyal? And yet millions of, forgive my technical term, schmucks, fans will be loyal to their team in the tune and leave huge amounts of money in their wills to these organizations, to these places when there's so many better charities. Why? What is it about these fans that are, and these are graduates very often of prestigious, high-quality academic institutions like Notre Dame and Berkeley and Stanford. How could such smart people be so stupid in the way in which they allocate their money and time?
Well, you know, I'm not going to call them stupid. I mean, I think there's this thing called loyalty, and football truly brings it out at the college and professional level. And, you know, the other thing is we tend to focus on people who are those fans as opposed to the people who aren't fans, so they get a lot more attention. And it's a very huge economy that generates a lot of money and a
right.
lot of jobs, you know. And so that part of it's not surprising. I don't have that gene in me. I mean, I still will watch football games, but I watch them purely, you know, to watch the games, to watch the play. I have no, you know, I'm not a fan of any particular team anymore. And, you know, so I don't really understand that loyalty thing. The other thing that's interesting, I will tell you, though, going down the line, say 10 years from now, we have the same conversation. It will be interesting to see whether there's still the same level of loyalty because there's a number of disruptive factors out there, ranging from technology to, you know, the younger generation of students who just started school now are much more distracted and less loyal to football, less interested in going to the games. You know, they're walking out of games at Alabama, of all places.
Really?
Yeah, Georgia had to buy back 2,000 tickets from the student section this year or last year? I can't remember. Because, you know, there just wasn't that much interest. Now, the flip side is Georgia turns around and puts that back in the pool and then sells it to people who are desperate to go to a game, who are willing to pay thousands of dollars to, you know, to secure a seat. So they make money in the short run. But in the long run, I worry, if I were an athletic director, I'd be worried about the loyalty going forward.
You know, I think that's
a great point. I really do think that it's not a bubble, but I think there's going to be less interest, and then throw the concussion issue on top of it.
Exactly, and of course, ever more commercials. You know, when I first watched a football game was 2.5 hours, and there was probably 15 or 20 minutes of commercials. Now it's 3.5 hours and an hour of commercials. And if you're live in the studio, it's a quote a TV timeout. It absolutely dissipates whatever momentum is in the game. I think that's a good point.
And now this year, it's endless advertisements for betting on fantasy sports teams.
Right. Right, right. Let's move proactive. Let's look at what could be done. So, one of my ideas, and then I'm going to share with one you shared with me in the pre-interview. We'll do that in a minute. But it seems to me that part of the reason that football and basketball in college have grown so big is the lack of a minor leagues. In baseball, there are a whole professional minor league. So the athletes who are sham athletes who have a 2.0 GPA and horrific SAT scores don't have to go through this sham of going to quote college, be a college student athlete. And do you think there is validity to the notion that the antidote to this problem is to creating minor leagues in football and basketball?
I don't know that I'm expert enough to say, but let me just think out loud for a minute.
Right.
I think that it's one potential solution, but I think there are a whole bunch of important issues that come along with that if you do it. So if you go to a kind of minor league structure, are you then taking it out of the universities? I don't think you're going to have. It's going to be easy to get rid of these teams from universities. Not at the moment anyway. Mm-hmm. The bonds are so strong that I think all hell would break loose if you tried to say, we're going to basically give our team or sell our team, to this group of investors to set it up as a minor league.
Good point.
So it gets tricky that way. You know, a corollary to this would be, okay, let's push football and basketball even farther onto a corner of the campus, pretend that it or allow it to operate like a kind of for-profit business. Then some people are arguing for this, and if you go to paying players real money, that's kind of the model you get pushed into. The problem with that is nobody's talking about the implications of doing that, and there are a bunch of them. And the most obvious one is the tax issue. If you do that, do you start taxing players? You know, is it income? Are they employees?
I'm going to interrupt you because we're out of time, and I want to make sure you had at least a little bit of time to respond.
Okay.
Your idea that you shared with me in the pre-interview, which was great, which is we could perhaps draw more attention to this problem if we did, instead of these universities saying, oh, look how good our graduation rates are, do a longitudinal study of what happens to college athletes 10 years out. Why do you think that hasn't been done?
All I can interpret is that the NCAA doesn't want to do it because they're afraid what it's going to show. I mean, this is the most obvious thing for them to do, to take a class of teams, 65, different rosters, run them out 10 years, and let's see what the results are. You know, instead of talking about, our graduation rate is X, let's look at what actually happens to these football players over 10 years. Are they employed? Are they on welfare? Are they live? Are they dead? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. Well, you have kept this hour alive. I'm, better late than never. We're certainly glad that you joined us. Gilbert Gaul is the author of an excellent book, and nobody has better credentials. 4 times he was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, in addition to having won twice. The book is Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. Gil Gaul, thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you, Marty. I really appreciate it.
Terrific. And that is the show for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Debbie Kennedy, and, of course, all of you for listening, and in the first part of the show, calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers. And my wife, Barbara Nemco, and I are going to do a switch sides in the middle debate on whether to work for $40,000 a year at your favorite nonprofit or $80,000 a year for a good for-profit. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
for the archives of Dr. Marty Nemko's articles, information on his 7 books, including How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemko.com. That's MartyNemko.com. And you can join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco.